Hello and welcome to season 7 of the Most Civil Podcast. I'm Mo, your host, and I'm thrilled to embark on this new chapter with you. As we kick off the season, I hope you get ready for more captivating conversations that celebrate cultural diversity and also delve into the personal journeys of our guests from all around the world. Throughout the season, we'll continue our tradition of exploring pressing issues and sharing intimate stories that resonate with our contemporary age. From navigating cultural nuances to overcoming life's obstacles, each episode promises to be a compelling exploration of the human experience. So, as your host, I welcome you to join us as we journey through the rich tapestry of global cultures, guided by the courage and vulnerability of our guests. Together, let's ignite curiosity, find inspiration, and set our stories free. Welcome aboard. Now, enjoy the show. This is your girl, Mo. For just joining us for the first time, thank you for tuning in today. I imagine the topic of discussion today is as interesting as, you know, it is for me. So before we get started, I just think it's nice to lay some background. So for those who don't know, I'm a transracial adoptive mom. I have a daughter who's trans, she's some mixed heritage, and we adopted her when she was 2. But we had a for 11 months before then. So a lot of what you'll be hearing about today will be from my personal experience. So that's my bias jumping into it. And then special shout out to my sister and my friend, Nancy Cici Mulenwa of the Concrete Pastures podcast. She actually had this guest on their podcast, and listening to it, it brought up a lot of feelings, some very strong feelings. But I wanted to talk to this guest because I had follow-up questions. And the hope is that we're able to have a conversation just around adoption and what parents can do. And at the end of the day, is to provide support for both adoptive moms and also people that are adopted. And our guest today has done a lot of work in providing that support for transracial adoptees. Her story is very unique, and I hope that today we're able to, you know, delve into that. And I consider the privilege to have her on the podcast. So thank you to Nancy for kickstarting that conversation, because without her, you know, I won't be able to know about this lady. And so today we'll be talking about identity, self-discovery, family dynamics, cultural influences, and so much more. So as a bit of a bio, she considers herself a guide through life's complex journey, especially for Black adoptees. With her coaching, she helps them uncover their roots, embrace their identity, and flourish. Her diverse background in education, beauty, arts, and charity gives her a unique perspective. She's also the host of the Black Adoptees Identities podcast, where she shines a light on the stories and experiences of adult adoptees, creating a community where every voice matters. She's also a creative soul. She expresses herself through fashion, film, writing, and exploring the deep connections between culture, heritage, and identity. Everyone, please join me in welcoming Christelle Pellicure to the podcast. Hello, Miss Christelle.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you. Now, for my listeners, yeah, I'm going to be giving you an assignment. Yes, the professor is coming out. You have to go listen to Nancy's podcast, because we're not going to be covering a lot. I want to give my girl, you know, her flowers, because she's done a lot of work already. So go listen to her podcast and then come back and listen to this one. So we're not going to be talking about a lot of her background. But just a little bit of a refresher, can you tell us some of your personal journey of self-identification as a transracial adoptee from Madagascar? So you're raised by white French parents in rural France, and then you're currently living in UK and Portugal. My goodness, your geographical pathway will make Genghis Khan jealous with envy. So tell us a little bit about you.
Yes, of course. Yeah, so as you mentioned, I was born in Madagascar, and at the age of 10, my mother passed away, so I was then sent into a Catholic missionary school, and from there I was put into an orphanage and then ended up in France, adopted by a white French family. So that was my start of my journey of self-identification, because I had to forget everything that I know about myself, about being a Malagasy, because I had to embrace the French culture so suddenly, and not only the French culture but the white culture altogether. So I had to, in a way, reinvent myself and embrace whatever I was confronted with. And I lived in France until I was 18. And then I went to the UK to go to university. And I stayed pretty much my whole life after that for 25 years. I had my daughter there. I went to university there, and I worked my adult life in the UK. And 2 years ago, well, not quite 2 years, but almost 2 years ago, I moved to Portugal, because I just had enough of the British weather and needed some sun. But saying that, I still go back and forth to the UK quite a lot. So I am still in between the two countries.
Wow. Thank you for that. I'm sorry to hear about your mom passing away at such a young age. And did you have siblings, or was this just you at that age of 10?
Yeah, I had a brother, half-brother, but I also had, from my dad's side, some half-siblings, but I didn't grow up with them, so I don't really know them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then, wow. So, I don't know a lot about Madagascar, but the little I know is that it's quite homogeneous as far as culture, right? And then you have your Malagasy language, and then French is like a second language. So would you say that, I mean, moving to France is a totally different ballgame, and then moving to the rural part and then being raised by parents who are, you know, phenotypically different from you. But would you say there were some of the French part of the Madagascar culture that maybe were some protective factors for you moving to France, or was just a totally different ballgame?
No, it was very different for me, because where I lived was like a very small fishing village. So I didn't really speak French back then. I only spoke Malagasy and the dialect that we spoke in the village. So when I moved to the Catholic missionary, then I think that's when things changes, because I was slowly I shouldn't be speaking my own language. I should be speaking French from that time. And even when I got to the orphanage, I was actively having to take French lessons because I wasn't speaking French at the time. And definitely when I arrived in France, my adoptive parents didn't speak any other language. So I didn't really have any other choice than to be embracing that and conforming to that language. And even by the time I got to France, probably because of the trauma in itself, I've already forgotten Malagasy. I couldn't speak the language. And also I didn't have anybody else to speak with to try to maintain that language. So even today, I've met a few Malagasy friends over the years, but I've not been able to pick up the language again.
Man, I can imagine the losses, the compound losses, you know, losing your mom and then losing your culture, as it were. And then, but you're always reminded because you look black, you look African, but then it's like, I want to connect, but then I've lost it. So sorry to hear about that. I don't know if you remember much about the orphanage. How long were you there for?
Well, again, with the trauma, my timing is confused. I think my mother passed away when I was about 7, 8, and I was adopted when I was 10. So between the time I spent at the Catholic missionary, the orphanage, and being adopted, I think there's a couple of years that passed. But I've been also told that between the time my adoptive parents found out about me, going for adoption, and between the time I arrived in France, there was only 3 months.
3 months, wow.
So it was a very quick adoption, which also wonder how that happened, that, you know, he managed to get a child out of a country within 3 months of finding out about them. So, my timing is a bit blurred in my mind. I can't remember for
sure. That's understandable. I mean, trauma can do that to you, you know, and I think it's sometimes our brain's way of just protecting us from a lot of stress you've had. I don't, like, thinking about Madagascar, so if I want to contrast that to Nigeria, adoption is very, very hard in Nigeria. So what we end up doing most of the time is this soft fostering, where family members or distant relatives or even neighbors picking children and we don't call it adoption. You just go live with an auntie in the city, you know. Is Madagascar similar to Nigeria in that regard? Because I'm just... And then, do you also had... Was it a time where French nationals were just coming to Madagascar and just, you know, adopting babies? Because I know, for example, South Korea, they had that influx of white Americans going to pick up South Korean kids. They've clamped down on that. So, like, Holt agencies, for example, were doing that adoption between babies born of, you know, American soldiers and Korean moms, and then they could ship them away, you know, and that's caused a lot of issues to today, but they've clamped down on that. But in Madagascar, didn't they have a lot of family members stepping in to, you know, take care of kids whose parents were, you know, gone? And then was there also a vacuum that the Madagascar government allowed French internationals to come in and just, you know, take up kids and go adopt them?
Yeah, I mean, there's now there's a lot of kinship adoption, I guess, so when family members step in. But we, for my case, we're talking about 40 years back. So we're talking about, you know, the 80s, around 80s, and 80s is, you have to remember, Madagascar only had the independence from France in the 60s. So we're only talking about 20 years after independence. So a lot of things were still happening during that transition period. Although the country was independent, there was a lot of control still happening for France at the time. You know, I always say this, my grandparents would have lived for the colonization. So for them, it's a big trauma in itself of what the French did to the country. So they would not, because that was one of the questions I keep asking myself when I was adopted. Where are my family? Why did they not come to get me? And, you know, if they have to remember their own trauma, I don't think they would have had, you know, put themselves and go through that again and try to confront the French another time. And also because my mother decided, she was the one who left me with the Catholic missionary. So I think my grandparents have then respected that decision. But during, you know, when you talk about the 80s, I remember growing up, my family would warn us against the white people, the French. If you see a French person, just run. Because at the time, it was very common that children were being abducted and being kidnapped and disappear from the country. And that's why I say that during that transition period, there's still a lot of things that were happening that we don't really talk about very much in history books or anywhere else. So I think for my personal journey, it was a very strange time in terms of adoption. And I think there would have been adoption would have been done in a such not a legal way. I think some children would have been scooped away and being given to the French. You know, I have my own sister who, well, we're not blood related, but she was adopted from Madagascar. And again, her own story, she's been told that she was abandoned, but yet when she reconnected to her family, she knows she was never abandoned. She was left in the thinking that the family would come back to pick her up, but then they never found her. So there has been a lot of story. And, you know, even in other countries like Mali, I've heard, Mali, Ethiopia, I've heard this, you know, 20 years ago, it was very common that family would think, oh, I'm going to leave my child for education at the missionary, but then I will never see the child again. So at that period, it was, it's not quite the same. And to be fair, France have just closed down adoption with Madagascar back in October because it wasn't still very clear how the adoption system was working. There was no guarantee that everything was going through the legal system. So that is now suspended for France, and I don't think it will reopen anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, this is the more you were talking, the more it just dawned on me that we actually did have that wave in the 1960s of Nigerian kids being farmed to the UK. Actually a movie, Famine, you know, literally called Famine, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And it just dawned, like, oh my gosh, this was the tactics of the colonizers to, as a way, just keep colonizing. And my goodness, thank you for sharing that. And again, I'm so sorry for just the colossal loss. Like, I imagine that grief is has always been something that you're familiar with, because it's come in stages for you, you know, losing your mom and losing your identity and then starting anew. And so I'm just curious to know, moving to France, you know, and then you were there for 8 years living with them before you moved to the UK. Can you just describe what your life was when you were adopted?
Yeah, I think when I first arrived, I mean, I didn't even feel the grief. I think I didn't have the space to even think that my mother passed away. I think there's so many things happening at the same time, having to deal with the grief, having to live with the Catholic missionary, then going into the orphanage, and then taking a plane. I've never taken a plane in my life, and ending up into a white family. You know, you go from a country where a majority of people are black into a country where a majority of people are white. That is in itself a culture shock. So I think it's kind of the body and the mind trying to be comfortable with this new environment. I think I didn't have the time to even think what is happening. I didn't have the space to do that. It was just, I had to enroll in the system, just having to go with whatever was being asked of me. And to be fair, at the beginning, it felt like very safe and very, you know, comfortable way of living. You know, I was going, my mother homeschooled me from the first year because I wasn't really speaking proper French. Yeah. So I wasn't ready to go into school. And also because in Madagascar, I wasn't going to school every day because of the poverty in the country. So I had to catch up in a lot of the learning. So I stayed home for a year, and in a way that has been good because I didn't, I suppose, having to catch up with school as well immediately as I arrived. So it gave me a little bit of space in that sense. And I think I didn't really ask much question to my family. I think there was some internal question about where my family and why I was here to myself, but I don't think I was voicing. Well, I couldn't voice it because there's a language barrier. And also I didn't understand what was happening. I didn't understand if this was some kind of temporary thing that I was here. I didn't really, there was mention of the adoption world, but I didn't know what that meant at the time. So I think it was just going with the, almost like the enrollment system of what I've been told, this is my new life now. And I think for me, the adoption didn't really, I think in my teenagehood, when you start asking who you are, and, you know, that's probably when I start finding difficult to get an identity for myself. And by then also I ended up, because I was following the system, I ended up having to be people pleaser. I wasn't, you know, complaining so much. I was just following the orders, and it even thinks, you know, I was always the best at school because I felt like that was the only way I was recognized and being seen. So it was always this issues around perfectionism. So everything I had to do has to be perfect. Unfortunately, those things, it's good when you grow up, but when you become an adult, it's not always into your own benefits, because we know in adulthood that perfectionism doesn't take you anywhere because nothing is perfect. But, and even people pleaser doesn't help you in life very much. I think the early years, I didn't really feel that there was an issue with the adoption. I think it's later on, and definitely in my adult life, and when I had my daughter, that's when, especially the cultural side, it's when I really questioned myself, and seeing someone who looked like me finally being so close to me and my family, that's raised so many questions, and not being able to tell her about where we're coming from and what it's like to be in our own country and what's a tradition and things like that. I think that's when it started to really bother me, and all the questions asking myself. And I think that's when I then decided to do the journey back to Madagascar and found out for myself.
Yeah, connections.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very loaded. Thank you. So for your your family dynamic, do you have any siblings? I think I recall from Nancy's episode that you did have some siblings. Are you at liberty to tell me what your position was? Were you the first child, you know, and they had more kids after you, or there were some kids in between?
Well, there's a lot of kids in my household because my parents are foster parents. So there was about 4 or 5 children that were there kind of long term, and then there was other children coming in and out. My adoptive parents have 2 biological children of their own, so older than me. And then they adopted another girl from Madagascar after me. So there was a lot of us in the house all the time in that sense. So yeah, it's just a busy household.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Are you a liberal or just a dynamic between the, and I hate using this word, but just for the sake of clarity, between the biological kids and the adopted kids? And then given that the other, one of the adoptive ones was also from Madagascar like you, did you form a bond just from that shared experience, or are you just a liberal? Just tell us what the dynamics were among all the siblings.
It was interesting because the 2 biological children were into boarding school. So in a sense, I didn't really see them very often. We only see each other, we interact during weekends and holidays. I was mostly interacting with the foster kids, and my younger sister was been adopted after me. She was much younger. We've got 10 years difference. So,
wow.
There is quite a big gap in terms of, you know, she was 3 years old when she arrived. I was already 12 at the time. So in that sense, the communication at the time, we couldn't really talk about Madagascar or anything like that, or adoption. In a sense, it's only now we are adults that we talk a lot more about our own adoption and how it affected us and how we lived it. We both lived it very differently. But yeah, I think she's also, the things that I was feeling probably 8-10 years ago, she's feeling it now. So it takes time to come. To be processed through in a different, each person feel it differently as well. But yeah, I mean, it was a very busy household, but we were kind of connected quite a lot with the foster kids together.
Okay. And how about now? What's your relationship like with your siblings and also your adoptive parents?
It's not the perfect relationship, you know. I'm not, the closest I am is with my adopted sister. I think at the moment, right now, we talk a lot more than with the other siblings. I mean, we meet every Christmas and, well, we tend to meet at Christmas and holidays and, big event like that, but we don't talk like siblings. Some siblings talk every week. We don't talk every week. Because I think with the biological children, there is a disconnect because they haven't lived the adoption experience. It's always been their parents in a way. Whereas for me and my sister, because we are not the same color anyway, you will see, we are reminded every day that we are not the children, you know, not by the family, but by external world. So we've always lived with that in us, that we're reminded all the time that, you know, we were adopted. And also there is no, there's never been for that separation or the grief of losing a parent or being disconnected from your own family. So there is this, I think, in a way, that disconnect, because they can't sympathize, but they can't really be in our own shoes and really understand how we're feeling at times. And, you know, everybody has their own trauma and their own baggage, and we approach life in a very different way. So we're not that connected, unfortunately.
I'm so sorry to hear that. That's also another form of grief in a way, because, you know, I also imagine the age gap between you and the biological kids might also be responsible for not being able to have those shared experiences. How about with your adoptive parents, with your
Yeah, again, it's similar. I mean, we talk, we've not fallen out, but it's not a very deep connection either. It's we just starting now to talk about the adoption and how I lived it and how they lived it. But before that, there's never really been any talk. I think they've been so busy raising so many children in their life, and also the way they've been their own upbringing, there was no such an emotional attachment. And I think that's the bit that I've missed in my upbringing. That's because of the loss of my mother, I needed some kind of emotional attachment with a parent or a caregiver. And they were not able to do that, to give that to me. And I think that's kind of disconnected us as well in a way. But, you know, I know that they've done a lot for me. I'm not going to be where I am today without them. And, you know, and that is the dilemma of all of us as adoptee, because we have to be, we've always been told to be grateful because of what our family have done for us. So that's a kind of a big weight on us. And I know I am grateful for what they've done for me, but at the same time, I cannot forget all the loss and the grief that I have not been able to process for a long time until I was an adult myself to go through that. So it's a lot of things that was not processed during my upbringing that I had to deal with by myself later on. And, you know, and in this seat differently because, you know, in their way, they've always done the best that they could and they have, you know, they didn't know any better. But it's little things like for me, it's, you know, they could have created an environment where there was a lot more cultural education. They could have learned a little bit more about my own country. You know, it's two of us being adopted from the same country. They could have done a little bit more and being proactive and learning about that. So there's things that we don't really see the same way. But at the same time, you know, it's life. It is the way it is. I cannot blame them forever for not making the effort. Life happened the way it is. It is now my responsibility to step into my own life and take it to the direction that I want it to be.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question about the grief that you've been expressing a lot in just the short time we've talked about so far. So I'll come back to you. I don't want to dismiss that. But I had a follow-up question. So, I mean, lots of people, I think, including myself, we often feel like we don't quite belong to in our biological families. Like, that's always, since the moment I gained consciousness, I just always felt like I never belonged anywhere or with anyone. And it's not hard to imagine that there might be many adoptees who might attribute this feeling to being adopted when it might be driven by maybe our own personality as well, right? So what are your thoughts on this? Like, perhaps that feeling of not belonging could still be there if you had your biological parents living with you. So how are you able to separate, you know, that feeling from, you know, maybe it's just my personality versus perhaps it's just the adoption dynamic?
I think for me, it's that emptiness inside you. You know that something is missing, for sure. And, you know, I mean, in my personal journey, it's very different to other adoptees because a lot of adoptees are separated at birth. So they, in a sense, don't have the memory, but they have the knowing that they've been separated from deep inside themselves. For me, I have the memory. I know I lived with my mother for quite a significant amount of time. So I know then there is that separation for sure. But for me, the not belonging was, first of all, because it was a white environment and I didn't see myself. It was a very small village. There was not many people of color. I mean, around the village, there was people from North Africa, but there was nobody with dark skin living very closely. So I think that has already made me feel like, oh, I don't look like anybody. And there was no representation. So that definitely made me feel like I don't belong here. And, you know, I lived my whole life being by the seaside, going to the beach every day. And suddenly I was in the middle of the mountain between trees, and it was very different. So the whole environment, I think it's very important when you want to feel that connection and feel belonging. So I definitely didn't see this is where I was supposed to be. But the other problem, I think, for me is even when I went back to Madagascar, I didn't feel like I belonged. I've left for such a long time already, and I've already been programmed to be raised by white people. In a way, although I was black, I've become programmed to be white, behaving like a white person. So when I arrived in Madagascar, I definitely felt like I didn't belong. I didn't know how they were living their life. I didn't know anything about the tradition. And even when I arrived in the UK, and the UK was very diverse, and interacting with Caribbean people and black people, I felt very out of place because I didn't know how to behave like a black person, because all I've known pretty much all my life was being in a white environment. So I had to learn again to be comfortable in a black space, because deep inside me, it was the whiteness that's been invaded through my own body. So I think that's where the disconnection you feel, and you feel really out of place. Either you're in a white space or you're in a black space, and you're navigating between the two worlds, not really knowing where you belong. And, you know, I remember at the beginning of the podcast, you mentioning that I've moved around, and that is part of the issue. And I've only realized this recently, in the last couple of years, that the reason why I've moved around so much is because I'm looking for a place where I want to belong. It wasn't so much because, oh, I want to go there, I want to leave this. But it's because, you know, from before the age of 10, before I was adopted, I've already been to my grandparents when my mother went to hospital, then came back with my mother, then went into the Catholic missionary, then I went to the orphanage, then went adopted. So I've been to 5 different places before I even have the permanency of a place where I was supposed to belong. But unfortunately, I didn't feel like I belonged there, and then I left again. So there is this, I don't know, emptiness, and thinking that, you know, the next place you will find somewhere that where you're gonna belong. And actually, you know, nowadays I'm thinking like, you know, the only place you're gonna feel you belong is within yourself. So until you found that you are grounded within yourself, no matter how many places you're gonna move, it's gonna be the same. You're gonna feel like you're out of place. And I think many adoptees relate to that emptiness and not feeling that they're always looking for somewhere to belong.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for explaining that. And I imagine that for you, because you were adopted, you know, at 10, and by that age, you already have your memories, and you're able to do that contrast between, you know, the feeling of belonging and what it felt like to feel like you belong somewhere, right? And so, yeah, I appreciate you shedding more light on that. And as you're just talking, it reminded me of that book by, I think it was Paulo Coelho, The Alchemist.
Yeah.
How he went around the world, and then he found out that whatever he was searching was right there in front of him. And I do hope that, you know, as you're talking to other, through your network of providing support to other black, you know, transracial adoptive, and even with your daughter and parenting and all that, that you're able to get a semblance of that belonging back, because I still go through that. And again, I was never adopted, and I still always feel like I always never feel at home wherever I am, most of the places I end up being. And so in listening to you, I'm able to even experience that through you, even though our stories are so different. So perhaps it's a mixture of so many things, but we'll never know. But I really, really hope for you that, you know, as years go by, you're able to get that back, because there's nothing that feels quite as awkward and unfulfilling as feeling like you never belong anywhere. No one should ever feel that way. And your circumstances were quite strenuous, you know, and even you just picturing that for us. So my heart really, you know, breaks for you as well. And I want to say thank you so much for being vulnerable, sharing that. Let's talk about connection. So you've gone back to Madagascar. You've tried to regain that, right? How would you say your connection to that Malagasy heritage has been for you? And what are some efforts you've tried to make to maintain or even explore that part of your identity?
When I went back to Madagascar in 2010, originally I didn't go back to meet my family. The intention is I was going to do some social volunteer work. But while I was on the island, I just felt like I needed to go back to where my village, where I grew up. So, and again, when I arrived there, I didn't have any intention to track down my family. But, you know, as you know, when you go into a village, as soon as you arrive, news travel very fast. And next thing, the whole village knew that I was in the village. So everybody just gathered around, and ended up finding my mom's brother. And then some of my siblings and, my nieces and extended family. So the first connection was really, it was overwhelming, and it was beautiful and really nice to reconnect with people. And, you know, getting some of the questions that I had for a long time got answers, because, you know, in my mind, I was like, why is none of my family came after me? And hearing my uncle say that, he didn't even know that I was adopted. He didn't know what happened to me or where I've been. And it was kind of a big shock for me to turn up in the village like that, with not announced. But so that was really nice. The first impression was really nice. But obviously, when things start to settle in, and that was a lot more difficult and challenging, because some part of my family was seeing me as this person coming from the West, coming to save them, and they had a lot of expectation, including financial obligation that they were expecting on me. And, you know, I was trying to explain to them that, you know, my life in the UK is not as they think it is. You know, I'm a single mother and trying to do my best to raise my child, but apart from that, I don't own a lot of things that, you know, they think I do, and, you know, definitely don't have the gold laying around in my house. But so that was really difficult, because it was a lot of pressure from them. They didn't understand where I was coming from. So very quickly I had to distance myself, because it was just too much pressure. I didn't know how to handle. I think it was just too much. You know, I was reconnecting with my family. There's that big joy, and then suddenly there's the other part, was feeling overwhelmed by all the demands. So I had to distance myself. And yeah, and since then, I've not really connected that much with them. You know, there's letters and phone calls from time to time, but I have kept my distance. It's only in 2022, my brother passed away. I had to reconnect, because, again, there was that sense of guilt, because, okay, I had my chance to reconnect with my family, but I distanced myself, and now I've lost that chance to even build any connection to the closest person, was my brother, to any of them. So, but at the same time, you know, I have to just accept the situation how it is. You know, it was difficult. And I think nobody's really prepared with all this adoption story, with all the reunions that, you know, like adoption agency doesn't really prepare any adopted child that if you get reunited, this might happen. There is no, we have to just go into it. And but sometimes reunion are very good, but some very often, I think in a lot of the podcasts I've had with other adoptees, very often it doesn't hand up very well, this reunion journey, because everybody have lived a different life for such a long time and see life very differently. So it's very difficult then to bring people together and expect things to be the way one person expected to be. So yeah, so that, but that didn't really stop me. I wanted to, there was that need to reconnect with Africa and all the heritage and the culture itself. So I have done a lot of learning and reading about Madagascar and Africa. And actually, before I left the UK, I was doing a lot of work around African history, and I did a whole exhibition, and I did two short films around African queens and African kings. So I've still got that big connection with African history and Madagascar, and I did a whole series about the last queen of Madagascar and how she was treated by the French. So I did reconnect in that sense with the cultural heritage side of Madagascar, but not so much with my family. And my next thing is really to go back and take my daughter with me for her to also to learn about the culture itself. So that is something that I'm preparing to, and I have to try to prepare her a bit better than I was when I went there. So that is the next trip that I would like to take over there. And also documenting it into a documentary when we go back.
I'm so sorry. I guess I can definitely imagine the joy of trying to reconnect with your African roots, and we can say some things never change with the black tax. So there's a part of me that goes like, oh my goodness, like facepalm moment. But I guess what could be more of an African welcome? Like, you're literally part of us, so you should get that black tax. And families, let's do better, okay? That's all I'm just trying to say with this. And I'm so sorry you went through that. What a loss that connection is now quite fragile just because of, you know, those actions. I'm so sorry to hear that. I have many questions, but we don't have a lot of time. So let's do it this way. In talking about your parents, I know when many 40 years ago, parenting, you know, wasn't the same as it is right now. I mean, some things are still classic, but a lot of resources. And I know with social media and so many tools now being available, adoption has really, I want to say it's gotten a little bit better as far as things you should do better, right? And I imagine that you being a mom has, I mean, your child is 25, so it's not like a new baby. But I imagine, like, parents, like, maybe it brought up a new wave of grief for you because this is you doing it. And I don't even know if your daughter is, you know, of the same nationality and ethnicity as you, that can also maybe even create another layer of, you know, the dynamic might also change. But I guess my question, let me just wrap it in a ball. What are you trying to do differently, right? Having to pass down the best of both worlds, you know, both your Malagasy heritage and the cultural background of your French upbringing to your daughter, and how you're also navigating those complexities of you now being a mom, but you're also a transracial adoptee.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I think I ask myself this all the time. I think when I had my daughter, I was 20. So I was in the middle of even finding out who I was. You know, I didn't know who I was. I want to say I was a child raising a child. You know, I was still going through my own struggle of the adoption and my own identity and trying to know who I was. And then suddenly I had to take care of another human being. So I guess in a way that helped me to grow faster than, you know, most 20-year-old, because, you know, I was going to university, or my friend was going partying every night. I was going on to feed a baby, a 3-month-year-old baby. So that's in itself, you know, if I had to raise a child again today, it would be very different, because I have grown so much more than I was in my 20s, and I know things that I didn't know back then. So I was just, you know, for me, I think it was a survival mode at the time. the way I was raising my daughter and the things that I didn't get from my parents, I was not able to pass on to her. It was just a learning curve. And I think that's where I kind of understand my adoptive parents a little bit more, because the things they didn't have, they couldn't pass on to me. And it's the same things with my daughter. And unfortunately, it's also go the other way around. You know, the trauma I had, I've passed it on to her. So, you know, now we are both adults. We can talk about those things and unpack it. And the conversation help, the awareness help to heal from those things. But it was a difficult time, you know, raising a child when you don't know who you are and you're struggling so much about your own identity. It wasn't easy. But I would say, you know, there was a period where when she became a teenager, it was very difficult for her as well to understand, because she's always been raised in the UK as well. So she's not even feeling the French side, because she only go to France for holiday. So she's more, you know, although she's got a French passport, she's all feeling a lot more British than I feel. I don't feel British at all, even though I spend most of my life in the UK. So it's a slightly different, I think feeling, but the identity piece is, I think, still the same, because we're still trying to find out who you are when there's so many different pieces coming together. And she's also got another layer, because her dad is from Sierra Leone, so there's another piece she's got to pick up as well in that side. So yeah, the identity piece is it's very complex, I think, to try to understand who you are. But definitely, I think over the years, and she's also been my biggest teacher, you know, she's been, like I say, I've grown up so much more having her around me, and she's taught me as a 25-year-old adult now, she's still teaching me a lot of things that, you know, I shouldn't know, but she's teaching me. And that is beautiful in itself, because that's brought us closer together. Because with the age gap we've got, it's a learning process altogether. So I'm still learning things as I move on into my life at the moment. So yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, especially the racial connection and reconciliation, you know, the dialogue, intergenerational dialogue about identity and cultural heritage that you have with your daughter. And I loved a lot of things you said, but I think something you said around that I wanted to tag on, about how having your daughter also made you appreciate, you know, your adoptive parents, because you realize that, man, you know, you can want to do it the best way, but then you still drop the ball, you know. Parenting can definitely humble you. And I can relate to that as well. Like, you know, before I had my daughter, I criticized my parents a lot. And then I'm like, my goodness, how do people do this? There's no manual in the world that will prepare you for things that will, you know, hit you. But I think just owning the fact that, you know, you're going to mess up a lot as a parent, but that shouldn't still stop you from striving to, you know, be that best, as best you can at it. And then also leaving that room for dialogue. I think being able to communicate with our parents and our children, you know, these are my shortcomings. You know, I know I dropped the ball on, but leaving that room for communication. And I feel like that's where a lot of us struggle with. So here's just a recommendation. Parents, leave that space for your children to communicate with you. Nothing beats that. Because you drop the ball. We're humans. We haven't done this before. We're just learning as we go. So it's a very, very dicey work. Now, as we round off our conversation, we've talked a lot about the grief you've gone through. And when you talked earlier on about one of the things you thought your adoptive parents would have done better, since they took the onus they took on themselves to go all the way to Madagascar to adopt not just one, but two beautiful girls, at the very least, they could have learned a little bit about your culture and maybe found a way to integrate it. That's a very good, you know, suggestion. But I'm curious to know what additional steps you believe, you know, adoptive parents, especially those that are of the transracial variety, can take to ensure that racial connection and reconciliation with the adopted children?
I think for me, it's that bringing the culture into the house is important, but actually it's also about them being involved in that culture. So we always ask for the child to be uncomfortable and move into this white space or whatever space they've been put into. But the parents never make themselves uncomfortable and go into those black space. You know, we're talking about if you are go to church, take the child to a black church, take the child to a black celebration where there's a lot of black people around. So it's not always the child who have to do the uncomfortable thing. You are the parents who have decided that you wanted to take care of that child. And that means that it also means that you'll have to do some uncomfortable things in life to accommodate for the child and to support them in their own growth and in their own journey. So for me, I think it's not just about having little things around the house, but being involved in the child life. And that means being involved in the community where the child come from, and actively involved. And also it's a long life learning about the culture. You know, you cannot just buy one book when the child arrive and then finish that journey. You know, the child will have different needs throughout their different age. So that cultural education will change throughout the child life. So having to develop at the same time as the child and continue to do that journey of the child throughout their life, I think it's really important. I think even accompanying the child to their own birth country, you know, things like that, if you're able to afford that type of things, I think that is really valuable to be able to share with the child what it's like to be in that country, what life is like in that country, and have that discussion with them. And definitely, I mean, I see very much in, with the American adoptees that I speak to, you know, there's no talk about race, and that is very damaging for the child sometimes, especially in America right now, because the child is so being overly protected in that family surrounding. But when they get into the outside world and they have to face an everyday basis that they are black and they will be treated as black, and then they have to face a race, but they've never talked about it or nobody has prepared them to talk about it. And you only come up in conversation when something bad has happened around race for that child. And I think that's where, you know, adoptive parents need to be ready to talk about race. And, you know, if they're not comfortable about talking about it, they need to find someone before even adopting, I would say. So by the time the child arrives, they are comfortable to talk about those topics. So I think there is quite a lot of things that parents can do to prepare themselves. And the other thing that generally adoptive parents recommend is in terms of their own journey. I think it's questioning their own journey. How far are they in their own journey of healing, in a way? Because sometimes I see adoptive parents have not done sometimes they need therapy and they haven't done that. And that can impact on the child life later on. Something that happened in the child life can trigger them, and then it does end up being put on the child. And I think, and that's, like I said, it's generally for any adoptive parent, just to be really questioning, am I ready to be embarking in this journey of being a parent? Have I dealt with all my monster, or am I, you know, my shadows, and am I willing to confront my own shadow if it happens to come up, and I'm not going to be taking this on the child? So I think being very prepared in that side, that, you know, I am prepared to do whatever it is for the need of the child, for the best interest of the child.
Thank you so much. And I mean, those are good points. And I imagine 40 something years ago, there were not many resources that are available for parents, you know, who embarked on this quest. But this is an age of enlightenment, you know, we're in the fifth industrial revolution. So I guess the challenge for parents, period, is getting involved in your children's lives, and whether adoptive or not, what are their interests and how can you put that in conversations? And there's so many, many layers of complexity to this. And it's not even saying that parents that have done exactly all of this, the kids will still not have something to, bring up later in the future, because that's how parenting can be. But I guess the challenge and the humility here is that leaving those room for conversations and both ways for parents and children alike. And so I hope that this episode is very encouraging to those who listen to it. Because when I was listening to the episode with Nancy, I mean, I just thought about 20, 40 years from now, if my daughter got on the podcast and, she expressed her heart, like, what could I have done as a parent? How could I have made her experience better? And I wouldn't know. I mean, we keep trying our best, but I imagine that there'll be some things she will still talk about in the future. And that should be okay. But I don't want to miss things that I'm able to work on now as a parent, because I have my own layers of complexity too as a human being, and then how much more as a mom, and having a child was so different from me in every sense of that word. But what unites us together is, the love we have for her. And, and I hope that she always remembers that she belongs somewhere, and that, adoption as it were is a grief. It's a grief that you can never, it's just what it is. Picking a child from somewhere and bringing him home, there's that grief that comes with it, but it shouldn't always be a sad thing. And that's what I'm just trying to emphasize. And I thank you so much for, sharing all of what you shared today. And before you go, real quick, I know you have your podcast and you have your own mission. Are you just at liberty to tell us quickly about what you do and where people can find you?
Sure. So I'm a coach, first of all, which I support Black adoptees with their adoption journey. But as you mentioned, I've also got a podcast where I interview Black adult adoptees with their own journey. So that has been really useful to see that all of us, we go through similar experiences, similar emotions and feelings, even though our stories are always very different. And you can find me on Instagram at Black Adoptees Identities.
Thank you. I'll put all of that in the show notes. And I guess lastly would be two things. Looking back on our discussion today, what do you hope listeners can take away from your story and experiences? If you could tie everything in a little ball.
Well, I think I would have, for adoptive parents, is really think about the child's needs and really invest in their culture and their heritage, be there with them as much as you can, being involved in their life and do the education at the same time they educate themselves, the child educate themselves. So do the journey together. I think that would be my message to parents.
And I think that would go even for non-adoptive parents as well. Yes. So yeah. There's no excuse, parents, okay? And then for your community, especially for those who listen to you, they can relate to that grief we talked about, and that's, not having that sense of belonging. What are your hopes and aspirations, for them, and what kind of steps can they take in at least being able to? Because I feel like when you're able to express what you're going through, that's half of the problem being solved, like being able to articulate that, oh my God, this feeling is grief, right? This is what I've been feeling all these years. What are your hopes and aspirations for them?
I think for me, it's for everyone to be able to know who they are. And that's just really doing a lot of work around self-awareness. And, we might not be able to track down where we're coming from in our own roots and our parents, but you can do the work to find out who you are. And that's come, it doesn't have to be something where you are, our identity evolves all the time, and we don't have to be defined by the adoption story either. We can overcome that story if that story wasn't positive. You can build whoever you want to be out of who you are today. So really knowing what do you like, where do you want to be in 10 years time? So asking those questions, who do you want to be? What do I want? Where do I want to be? And what do I like? those small, it seems like small question, but in the big scheme, it does help to define who we are and we're moving forward to. So I think self-awareness is, I think, my big step and hope for people to be self-aware as much as they can.
Thank you so much. And oh my goodness, this has really been very, very rich. And I've learned a lot from you today, and you just sharing your experiences. And I know you come very well decorated. I forgot to mention, you've been awarded a lot. Bristol BME Palace, West Women of the Year, and all of the things you do, which we haven't highlighted. So we hope you find, you know, you come back again, and maybe we can talk about your other ventures and, you know, enlarge our horizons with the, you know, wonderful work you do. And I forgot to ask this. We didn't talk a lot about your dad's side, like your birth dad's side. I don't know if you had any connection, or when you were talking about connecting your African roots, were they the people you're also trying to connect with?
Yeah, my dad's side, I don't really have much, to be honest, because even when I lived with my mother, I didn't know who he was. But interestingly enough, it's I've not seen the paperwork, but apparently my dad signed my adoption paper. And for me, it's like, how is that possible? I didn't know who he was. Mm-hmm. How can he be signing? So again, you know, in all this environment where everything is, we don't know who's who and who signed papers. It could have been anyone who pretend to be my father, you know, just for the sake of someone needing to sign the paper. So I don't know. And I have a half-sister who contacted me when I was about 15, who strangely enough found my address in France, which again is very strange because it's a closed adoption. Nobody should be able to track me that easily and find my address in the middle of a tiny village in France. So there's a lot of things that, you know, it's very strange. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. But and she's supposed to be from my dad's side. And again, I've not kept a very close contact. She lived in Paris, but we've not met in person over the years. You know, we connect on Facebook and everything, but I've never really, because I don't feel, you know, like deep in my heart, because I have to feel that, you know, there is a connection, like, you know, the separation. Yeah. You feel that separation. So I do feel like, okay, if there is a connection between us, I would feel it. It didn't feel the same way as I was connecting with my brother, for example. So I haven't made the effort to really put myself out there and go meet her, because I don't know, I didn't feel that, you know, all the story I've been told is actually what it is. So I'm not really, maybe I will, you know, I guess one thing that's adopted is being lucky with at the moment is having DNA test, because that has helped them a lot. And maybe, I mean, in France, adoptees are not allowed to use DNA right now, so that's an interesting thing. So if but maybe that's way I will find out with my own family at some point, is doing a DNA test to put my mind at peace, to know that yes, you are really blood related.
I imagine the mushroom is gonna just sprout out, like, good luck with that.
Exactly. So I have to be prepared, because like I say, I've got no guarantee that, you know, the people pretend to be my family are my family, because
and families,
so it's another layer. I'm not sure I'm ready to
say no more. We understand. Say no more. But seriously, my prayer for you is that, you know, if Portugal is a place for you, that wherever you find yourself next, that becomes more of a resting place for you, and then that sense of belonging, you find it. And I really want to thank you today for the insightful and thought-provoking conversations we've been able to have. You coming on the show and extending that conversation on Nancy's podcast, just want to say thank you so much. It means a lot to me as a podcaster, and also as a transracial adoptive mom, to be able to have this conversation, almost like seeing to my daughter many years from now and being able to have these conversations, and also get support for not just parents alike, but also for adoptees as well. So thank you so much, Christelle, for this.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I would have to come back some days and
Let's do that. However we can support your podcast as well, please let me know. I'll keep in touch with you, and I want to thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, thank you all for tuning into this episode with Christelle. We hope you're able to get some nuggets from this. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you will be alerted on new episodes. I remain your host, Mel. Love you guys, and bye-bye.